this seminar is a joint effort with the Environmental Law Institute and the DC Bar's Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources section of the Energy Committee, and is supported by the Cohen Foundation. And I'd like to thank them for providing us with the support, because that means that we can present this to all of you for free, which is, I think, something that we haven't been able to do, or we can't always do with the seminars that we produce. Our seminar series is called Managing Industrialized Oceans, and this is the first of six. Future seminars will focus on energy development, alternative energy development, as well as expanding oil and gas development. And we have two upcoming seminars that are slated, one for March. Right now, our tentative date is March 19th, but we'll send out an email to everybody letting you know the precise dates. It will focus on ports, shipping, and air emissions. And a second seminar will focus in May on what we are calling noisy oceans beyond Navy sonar, and look at specifically ocean noise from commercial shipping, as well as some of the industry activities that take place out there now, and also what could take place in the future. I think that this seminar will be a good foundation for what's to come, because as we focus on some of the specific topics in future seminars, I think the issue of scientific and regulatory uncertainty is one that we're going to continue to revisit. I wanted to briefly make some comments about the seminar today, and then introduce our panel. My plan is to be done speaking at 25 after, so we can give our panel a chance to provide comments, and then we'll leave a half an hour at the end for all of you to join in the discussion, as well as take questions from the phone. Aaron, I hear music from one of the phones, so I don't know if that means they're on mute. So, emerging and expanding ocean uses.
If that is your intention, please press 1. Otherwise, press 2.
I'm still hearing
somebody
you.
Somebody's on hold.
Okay, thank you. So first of all, what are the emerging and expanding ocean uses? We have alternative energy development that's taking place. Waves, tides, and current energy are possibilities. Certainly wave energy is up and coming off the Oregon coast, and there's a big push there for that. Offshore wind is another expanding energy that and we've seen or all heard about. The fights in Massachusetts, as well as the oil or the leases off of the Texas coast. Oil and gas industry is expanding into deeper waters and new places. I'm sure many of you have heard about the fights in Alaska that are over polar bears and oil and gas development, and I expect that those types of concerns will continue and expand as we look to the ocean to provide for our energy and other resources. Another big challenge is certainly a driver for change is climate change, and how do we address the scientific uncertainty and regulatory uncertainty surrounding climate change with all of the things that are taking place in the ocean. In terms of scientific uncertainty, I thought that a survey that was released yesterday highlights the challenge that we're facing. There was a USGS and NOAA survey in off of the Arctic that identified 100 nautical mile slope that exists that we were not aware of before. I mean, that's a pretty huge discovery. And if you think about that, that's a geographical formation that's been there for forever, right? And consider then what we know about biology. I work off the coast of California at Scripps and based there, and one of my colleagues there was telling me that they discovered two new species of worms off the coast of California, right off of Scripps Pier, essentially. And that's an area that's been well studied in terms of biology for a long time. So we really know very little about the ocean, and that's a challenge in terms of how to manage it appropriately. So we've got a couple of scientists on our panel today that can talk to us about the scientific uncertainty and how that links then to management and regulatory uncertainty. I'm just going to talk about this. In terms of regulatory uncertainty, I think one of the best examples right now is what's happening with alternative energy development. There's potentially three competing authorities. We have the Energy Policy Act of 2005 that gives Minerals Management Service the authority for leases for alternative energy development. We have the Federal Power Act, which provides FERC the authority over hydropower, which they've interpreted to mean to include wave, current, and tidal energy, which is alternative energy. And then states have authority over their coastal zone, and there's a question about their authority to ensure that federal agency actions are consistent with their enforceable policies in the coastal zone. And so I think these things are going to be a challenge for those people who are trying to work in the ocean environment. So I'm hoping that we can explore some of those issues today, and we have four fabulous panelists who are going to take on this challenge, and the way that we've structured it, each of them are going to provide about 15 minutes of comments, and then we'll turn it over to the audience for questions. Let me just introduce our panelists, and I'll do it in the order that they're going to speak to us today. We have Bill Dennison, Dr. Bill Dennison, who is from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He's a professor of marine science as well as the vice president for science applications. And he coordinates the Integration and Application Network that is a group of scientists who are focused on applying science to management. And Bill has just come back recently from a 10-year stint at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, where he worked on marine botany. He holds a BA from Western Michigan University, a master's from the University of Alaska, and a PhD from the University of Chicago. His research includes seagrasses and brown tide algal blooms, and is working right now with a group of scientists at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis on seagrasses and seagrass conservation. So he's going to talk to us about some of the issues related to scientific uncertainty and principles such as the precautionary principle as well as adaptive management approaches. Next, we have Karen Hansen over here, who is a principal with Beveridge and Diamond, and her practice focuses on water law, regulation, and policy, and specifically she works on disputes over water quality and use, the impacts of land-based uses on coastal and ocean resources, as well as emerging regulation of new and traditional uses of water, including oceans. Carla Sullivan, who's at the end here, is a senior policy advisor for NOAA, and she serves as an agency liaison to the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. She served from 2002 to 2007 as the executive secretary for the National Science and Technology Council Committee on Environment and Natural Resources and the U.S. Group on Earth Observations. She serves as the Department of Commerce's representative to Minerals Management Service Outer Continental Shelf Policy Committee. And she holds a JD from the University of Mississippi. These are brief highlights of the folks who are up here. I have much longer bios, so I could spend probably the next half hour telling you about all of their accomplishments. So these are just some of the highlights. Dr. Margaret Linen is here with us today from Climos. She's the vice president and chief science officer. Climos is a company that is developing technologies to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And one of the things I'm hoping that she'll talk to us today about is the iron fertilization as a potential way to encourage carbon sink in the ocean. Dr. Linen was previously the assistant director for geosciences at the U.S. National Science Foundation, and she managed the geosciences directorate at NSF that funds research initiatives in ocean, atmospheric, and earth sciences. She served as the vice chair of the U.S. Climate Change Science Program, the interagency program responsible for coordinating federal climate change scientific research, and as co-chair of the National Science and Technology Council's Joint Subcommittee on Ocean Science and Technology. Dr. Linen is also a researcher of paleoceanography, paleoclimatology, and ocean biogeochemistry. So we have a couple of lawyers and a couple of scientists that are going to help us think about some of these challenges. And I guess it's nice that I'm well placed in the middle. I didn't introduce myself, so I probably should have started with. I'm Catherine Mendrink. I direct our ocean program. And I both have a background in marine biology and a PhD in from Scripps, as well as a JD. And I'm now focused on the integration of science and law and policy. So I'm very excited about today's seminar. And with that, I'll kick it off and let Bill provide us with some comments.
Thanks, Catherine. It's great to be here. And I hope you don't share the post-traumatic driving syndrome that I'm going through after my trip today and yesterday. I've heard from Mark and Carla, you have post-traumatic walking syndrome. Kind of out the front door. What I was going to do is tell you three stories that relate to scientific uncertainty, and then use that as a background to talk about what I consider a pretty exciting new governance model for managing science that we're experimenting with in Maryland. So I'll start by echoing Catherine's earlier comment that we don't know much about the ocean. One of the things scientists tend to do is talk about what we do know, and I think it's important also to talk about what we don't know. My first foray into that was when I was 20 years ago, when I was a postdoc. I got an opportunity to work at Stony Brook and Long Island. I lived on my boat, and I would go out and look at this great South Bay, and I came back, and the water was really turbid, and I kept coming back and saying, I can't see my hand in front of my face. What's the matter? And, oh, it's just stirred up. And, well, it turns out it was this brown tide, this new alga that nobody described, this with all these up in Narragansett Bay at the same time and down in Barnegat Bay in New Jersey. So we were really, we didn't know who, what, where, when, or how this thing came, let alone why. So I, at one point, I had a New York Times reporter spend a day with me on the boat. Here's my chance for 15 minutes of fame. You know, here I could. My grandmother was a newspaper woman who kept asking when I was going to get a real job. And so here I had a chance to be in this pinnacle newspaper, New York Times. And the guy spent a day with me, and I blabbed the whole day. At the end, what he chose out of what I said all day in the headline was, we don't know much about the ocean, Dr. Bulnes. Well, my grandmother wasn't impressed. My family was like, why have you been in school so long? My colleagues were saying, well, you might not know much, but we do. So I got a lot of flack for that. But it's come back. One of the things we started a couple years ago in Chesapeake Bay is some ecological forecasting. Chesapeake Bay is the best studied estuary in the world, in the history of the world. We have more theses. We have more scientific studies. We have more paradigms that have been built on Chesapeake Bay. My colleague from University of Rhode Island, Scott Nixon, is always genuflecting to the queen estuary of Chesapeake Bay. Yet, we thought with this 20-year, 25-year data record, we should be able to predict what's going to happen this summer. We know enough to get ahead of the game. Well, we've been very disappointed in our ability to effectively predict what's going to happen before it happens. A lot of scientific papers talk about forecasting, but they're usually actually hindcasting. So we are confronted with the reality that we don't know enough to provide predictive models of what's going to happen even 3 months down the track. So that's my first point. My second point is that science and management or policy tend to be thought of as separate entities that operate more or less in different realms, and often in series. In other words, you'll do a scientific study, you'll commission a study, and then, like the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then you hand this to the policymakers, and they'll decide what to do with that. Well, I had an opportunity 15 years ago to start this enterprise where we were trying to work with local government and state and federal government in Australia on a cleanup campaign. Healthy Waterways Campaign, we called it. And I sat down with the stakeholders that we had cultivated and to get the money to start the study, and I was very proud of the fact that we were going to get out, and within a two-year time frame, we were going to compress everything and do everything in 2 years and give them a first cut. And a guy came up to me after the meeting and said, well, Bill, we're going to build this sewage plant. We wanted to know, do we put a pipe 1 kilometer or 10 kilometers offshore? I said, great question, perfect. You know, we got the physics, we're going to study that, we're going to have tracers, we're going to do nutrient chemistry, we'll be able to tell you the answer to that. I said, you don't really understand, but we're going to do this tomorrow, we're making this decision, so you're going to tell me today or I'm just going to have to flip a coin. So the realization right then and there is that the science and policy had to be connected from day one, interacting as we move forward. That's the true meaning of adaptive or ecosystem-based management, I think. And it was at that point when we started realizing that we had to give imperfect knowledge and communicate it effectively to the people that were making the decisions and not in just the people that we knew in the sitting in the position. It had to be a broader, all of the stakeholder kind of campaign. So we created this campaign in which we produced, we had a roadshow, we had newspaper, television spots, we did lots of brochures and books and booklets and at that time the web was getting geared up. So we did a lot, but it was really important that we had that constant dialogue. So it wasn't in series, it was in parallel, science and policy working together. And the third little story is still in Australia, and this was 10 years ago when we had convinced these guys that they needed to do something about the transitions of the ecosystem we're seeing. This is the fastest growing region of Australia, the Sun Belt, the fourth fastest growing region in the world at the time, in the 1990s. So this is a boom area, the Sun Belt, and people are moving in and expanding, and there are warning signs, algal blooms and other kinds of warning signs that things were going bad. So we had a model that we built, one of these computer models that simulated water flow and water quality. We had drogues and tracers that we put out and to watch the water flow. We had nutrient chemistry and the monitoring program. We had people out there measuring things all the time. And we were trying to show that these embayments were being impacted. And what we found is that there was a blame game going on. And everybody was saying, yeah, we know there's a problem, but it's not us, it's them. And it was always, and wherever you went, it was always somebody else. It was never personal responsibility. So the lesson we learned there is I had a student who was poking around and looking for something to do. So we put him onto this project, which was to take these little algae that grew in the water and put him out in the bay and he rigged up some bricks and little buoys and he went out and did it to map out these where the nitrogen that got sucked up by the macroalgae. We used a stable isotope analysis to distinguish the nitrogen that was coming from sewage from the background nitrogen. Made a beautiful little map, and I literally was waiting the day that map was being generated by the printer. It was one of those overhead, back in the days of overheads, and I pulled it out of the printer and went straight to the council meeting with this, just drying it off as I was walking to the car. Went to the council meeting, and they were having a big decision, a $20 million, $2 million upgrade of a sewage plant, which, based on the map, they saw that they had their own sewage problem that was specifically identified to their own plant, not somebody else. And the personal responsibility, they stepped up. They invested in the big sewage plant. I got to go to the opening of the sewage treatment plant, which was surreal. You know, we had lunch with the women, had to stand there and keep the flies off the sandwiches. And you know, every once in a while, a good whiff of the sewage would come around your way. But they were so proud of doing the right thing. The mayor, the deputy mayor at the time, now he's the mayor, told me that, look, this is the biggest single investment this council's ever made, and it's an election year, and we usually invest in parks and streets, things that people can see. Sewage doesn't really win votes, but we think it's the right thing to do. Well, and not only is it the right thing to do ecologically, but it was the right thing to do for the political realm. They got swept back into office, and like I alluded to, he's now the mayor. So some data is better than others. The data that provided a kind of a fingerprint was in, even though I think we could have told that same story, we tried to tell that same story with a lot of other data, this data resonated with people. So not all data is equal when it comes to policy realm. We followed that up with some tracer work we did on sediments, the other big problem we had, other than nutrients, was dirt. So we were traced the sediments using geochemical tracers, and we could tell the farmers, your dirt, your fertilizer is ending up here in the bay. It's a problem here. You need dirt. You need fertilizer. You shouldn't lose it. So we got the catchment. We got the farmers actually lobbying for the dugongs, the manatee cousins that were out in the bay that were getting impacted. So those three stories are to tell you that we don't know much about the ocean, that science and management need to be conducted in an interactive way, and that some data is more important than others. Well, the governance model I want to talk about for my remaining few minutes here is what we're experimenting with in Maryland. And we had a new governor elected in January, a year ago, Martin O'Malley. He was a big city mayor. He was Baltimore's city mayor. And he copied the model that Giuliani and those guys started up in New York, which was to map crime and then put police where the crime was rather than in the safe suburbs or, you know, safe neighborhoods. And then he did that with potholes, and then he did it with social services. Well, when he came and got elected governor, he said, well, what is it? Let's try this on the Bay. And so he created a thing called BayStat, BayStat. And he put on the panel the university and four of the departments. Interestingly, Department of Environment, obvious choice. Department of Natural Resources, obvious choice. Department of Planning, not as obvious, but important. Department of Agriculture, not your normal environmental group, but the biggest impact for the people he needed to affect, the farmers. So in these meetings, where we meet monthly, this is where science and management engage. The governor and chief of staff and deputy chief of staff are there. The budget people that they bring with them are there, along with the department secretaries and the university. And we have a conversation about what's happening, and it's all metric-based, and he uses the Socratic method to put the heat on. The Secretary of Agriculture has been sweating it out several times as the governor increasingly pressing the issue. How many best management practices do you have, Roger Richardson, the secretary? We have 6,000 farms. Okay. Well, how many of those are best management? How many have filed a BMP, a farm management plan? Well, how many inspectors do you have to see? You have 6 inspectors, 6,000 farms. How do you prioritize that? You don't prioritize that. Don't you think you should prioritize that? How do you have a GIS system? You guys don't have a GIS. You don't have a single GIS analyst. Turns to Rich Hall, the Secretary of Planning. Rich, you have a whole floor of GIS people. Can you help Roger over here? Boom. Government's working to try to do something. So this is going to be an interesting experiment. It is performance-based metrics. We've developed the Chesapeake Bay report card from the university side. We gave it a D+ last year. You might have heard about it on the news. We're going to give it another grade in April. And what we did specifically, though, is highlighted where, not just one number for the Bay, but where there are specific successes and failures. And that was, a big surprise. Upper Bay was better than anywhere else. Choptank River, Eastern Shore, rural, bucolic farmland was second worst to the Patapsco next to Baltimore, city of Baltimore. So that was a big revelation, followed up by Baltimore Sun front page, followed up by a whole raft of activities at the county level to try to. Nobody wants to get a bad grade. Motivation of peer pressure, motivation is very powerful, very powerful. So I guess what I'd like to conclude with is that we need to continue to experiment with ways of doing this better. If we look at the coastal oceans in general, we've had a 30% loss in seagrasses over the last, since 1980. We've had a similar loss of coral density. We've had 29% loss of mangroves. Think about it. Seagrasses are getting nailed because of dirt and nutrients. Mangroves, salt marshes, which are also being lost, love dark nutrients. They bring it on. It's our human footprint in total that's impacting our coastal ocean. We have to do a lot better. Our population move, migration, as well as expansion to the coast is making that more and more pressing. So we have to experiment with new governance models. We have to do what we're trying to do better. The science we're doing, we have to sharpen up. We have to turn it on its head. We have to be doing science for restoration. The governor asked us to help in the last few months. He got a $50 million bill in special session passed for diffuse source nutrient targeting to complement the flush fee for the $50 million that he got, that the previous governor got for sewage upgrades. Well, where do you do that? Where do you do that most effectively? $50 million is not enough, so you got to really target and really make that money go the farthest and have measurable performance metrics to see whether or not you're making wise investments, because these are big-ticket items. Fixing our coastal ocean is going to be, and ocean entirely, is going to be very expensive, so we have to be cost-effective and have good performance metrics to do that well. So I just encourage you to stay tuned. Watch this experiment. Watch these report cards come out. Watch they're pretty well publicized in the news and main media, and watch to see how the space deck comes out. It's transformative. It's a really interesting experiment, and I'd like to be able to come back in 5 years and tell you the story about how we saved Chesapeake Bay. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. I'd like to turn it over now to Karen, who's going to talk about the regulatory uncertainty in both nearshore and offshore environments.
Great, thank you. I'm just going to move a little closer so I can hear. Well, Bill talked about how scientists like to focus on what they know and not what they don't know. And I think lawyers are very similar. We like to focus on what we think we know and not on what we don't know, which is why you often hear a typical lawyer answer is, well, it depends. What I wanted to do today in the presentation time that is allotted for this is just really walk you all through a couple of illustrations of the problems with the current legal framework that we have, both in terms of federal and state and local laws in the United States and the international regime. And I'm going to just talk about a couple of different hypothetical examples, one related to sort of a pollution control orientation and the other to focus on the alternative energy regulatory framework that is beginning to emerge from MMS. For those who haven't looked at the two Ocean Commission reports in a while, they very clearly concluded, after running through a detailed analysis of all of the various legal frameworks, that as a matter of federal law, we were really in a very sorry state of affairs, that the entire federal policy framework for the oceans had not been given serious comprehensive study since the Stratton Commission back in the late 60s and early 70s, that the work of that body had formed the basis of many of our current environmental laws. Those laws are outdated in many, many ways. And the issues that I'm going to use for illustration today, I think, really underscore that. In the time since the commission reports came out in 03 and 04, there's been, I think, very little to really move the ball forward on the recommendations just for the policy framework and the legal framework. And Carla can talk about, but one of the recommendations that, very large recommendation and unwieldy, I think, in the political environment that we've been in, is to elevate NOAA, take it out of the Department of Commerce, make it a standalone agency, give it a blueprint agenda and strategy. And that, of course, has not happened. And I think one of the things that will be interesting a year from now to see is to see if oceans policy will get moved up on the agenda. And I think climate change is going to actually help to push it there, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit. The other point I wanted to make, though, about the commission reports is that in addition to the scientific and regulatory uncertainty. Those reports talk a lot about what we don't know about the oceans, how vast they are and how unexplored they are relative to, you know, even space or, you know, agricultural policy, how much is spent on that. And that there's a huge economic value in the oceans and in our coastal resources, and that if we as a society could really get our arms around that, there'd be a lot more stakeholders at the table. So I would just add that to the mix of things that maybe we can dialogue about here is just there's this other piece of the puzzle, I think, that if people who are interested in the oceans can tap into that somehow, we might be able to make more progress. So with those couple of introductory remarks, let me move into the two examples that I wanted to use to just illustrate some of the state and federal and international legal frameworks and some of the problems that arise. And even though Margaret is here to talk about Climos, and Climos is a vessel-based iron fertilization, you know, commercially oriented process, I'm going to talk about that as a prototype, but not about Climos in particular, just as that sort of vessel-based commercial use. So somebody calls me up and says, I'm so-and-so company, and I want to do a new use for profit in the ocean. What do I have to do? And there's some basic questions that you ask them. You know, where are you going to locate this? What kind of activity is it? Is it going to be tethered or located in some way on the seabed? And you find out more about it. And the answers to those questions begin to tell you sort of where your jurisdictional frameworks are going to come from. So using that as a starting point, if you have a proposal, you want to, you know, engage in a commercial use in the oceans within state and federal jurisdictional waters, within 3 miles, there are a set of legal requirements that are going to apply. The farther out you go, the less number of laws seem to apply and the less clear the application of those laws as a general principle. But if for example, you want to engage in a commercial use that's vessel-based within the three-mile zone, you're going to some of the laws that you're going to have to analyze include a couple of different provisions of the Clean Water Act. You're going to need to look at whether or not there are discharges from the operations that would constitute a point source under the Clean Water Act. And as soon as you start looking at that issue, you're going to run into the controversy out in the Ninth Circuit over ballast water. Right now, there's been a longstanding exemption under EPA's regulations for sort of typical operational discharges from vessels that was challenged a few years ago out on the West Coast, and the end result of which was the judge summarily threw out the exemption that EPA and the industry had been relying on for over 30 years. And the agency and all the stakeholders are right now engaged in a process to try to figure out if there's going to be a rulemaking regime and how to pull that together for the court-ordered deadline of this September. So what looks on the surface like a very straightforward application of a well-known law in that particular context becomes very, very murky right away. Another Clean Water Act provision is under 403. It's the ocean discharge criteria. And again, depending on where you're going to be and what you're going to be doing, you may be required to go to EPA and obtain a determination under that law that your proposed use is not going to cause unreasonable degradation. There is not a tremendous amount of experience with that. It typically has been applied for nearshore land-based operations such as energy facilities and POTWs. And so the way that the EPA might strive to apply that in a really different context, I think, remains to be seen. And there's a whole long list of things that they need to look at and a lot of technical studies that have to be developed to support an application to receive the negative determination. Another Clean Water Act provision that you might encounter is the 401 certification process, which is where states have to certify that a federally permitted activity within, in this example, within their jurisdictional waters is not going to cause water quality issues. One of the, you're talking about climate change, one of the interesting developments in the last year, and there was a petition to EPA just in the last 6 weeks or so, the Center for Biological Diversity has been trying to use the Clean Water Act's water quality standard programs and the TMDL program to address the issue of ocean acidification by getting the states and the EPA to alter the federal water quality criteria for pH, and then to seek to regulate greenhouse gases, you know, air emissions of greenhouse gases and runoff that go into the oceans and cause this problem. It's a very unique, novel, and probably ultimately unsuccessful legal petition, but it illustrates, I think, that people are making the connection between climate change and oceans and trying to use existing regulatory tools as sort of a blunt instrument to get some attention to the issues. Another federal regime under the Marine Protection Resource Act is ocean dumping permits. That's really built upon the International London Convention and London Protocol, which I'll touch on in a minute. But the idea is that if you're dumping material, which is generally considered waste, but it's not limited to waste, and you're doing that into U.S. jurisdictional waters, and it's been transported either to or from the United States, you're subject to that regime, and there are many, many interpretive issues about the basic definitional terms and what's within that. And I'll come back to that when I talk about the international regime in a moment. If you're looking at a vessel-based example, what's an operational discharge, and if that's at least arguably exempt from Clean Water Act jurisdiction, is it something that then can be nevertheless considered a dumping under a separate federal program, and so you quickly get into pretty murky issues like that. We've been talking about an operation that would affect the water itself, the surface of the water or the, you know, below surface, but what about if you're going to be tied to the bed of the ocean or need to lay a pipeline or something like that? You then get into additional federal programs, the River and Harbor Act, the Corps of Engineers, Clean Water Act 404 permitting process, which then gets you into the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act, to do environmental reviews. And all of those, whether it's a bed-based commercial use or a vessel-based commercial use, things like aquaculture, are also going to the extent that they require federal permits, they're going to raise, as Catherine alluded to, ZARMA, the Coastal Zone Management Act, and there will have to be a process with the state to certify that the federally permitted activity is going to be consistent with state laws and regulations, and there's a lot of discussion going on right now. That's clearly been a process that's been used in the oil and gas leasing context for many years, but as states, and particularly the Western Governors Coalition, Massachusetts, the Great Lakes, really try to assert a lot more authority in the absence of you know, a robust federal program to deal with some of these new issues, I think it's going to become more, not less, of an issue and a vehicle for states and regions to really try to ensure that what they've developed as state plans and regional plans get are embedded into the federal process. If you take the same hypothetical commercial use and move it out to the farther out, into the open ocean, what are the international regimes that you are going to run into? The primary one is the anti-dumping protocols under the London Convention and the London Protocol. Basically, those prohibit disposal of all kinds of materials, not limited to waste, but what exactly is covered or is not covered, I think, is unclear. If you're engaging in an activity that's going to, add material to the ocean, but it's not merely for the purpose of disposal, you're possibly exempt. But I think everybody can appreciate that that sets up all kinds of interpretive issues and very subjective determinations in trying to define what that means. One of the ways that people, in the absence of a lot of guidance in the international regime on some of these issues, people have looked to, well, what's the purpose of the convention? What's the purpose of the protocol? And clearly in the years that intervene between the two, you've got language in the convention about protecting marine resources in the protocol. It does that, plus, preservation and the precautionary principle is built in. And so you've got two freestanding legal authorities that sort of say different things, and how do you work within that regime. There are blacklisted substances under one, and then more of a prohibition like the Clean Water Act, a prohibition on discharge unless you get an exemption or authorization. So slightly different framework, slightly different terminology between the two laws. And the bottom line in this whole thing is that there's just simply a lot of uncertainty and a lot of interpretive issues under federal and international law. And one of the things that I think Margaret's going to talk about that Climos has done to try to contend with that murkiness is to develop a proposed code of conduct for people, researchers, commercial companies that would seek to operate in the oceans in the midst of this kind of uncertain legal regime. And it touches on, it sort of sets up a voluntary protocol for going and trying to get all of these permits without really arguing about whether they legally apply, but, submit the proposal to the regulatory authority, let them decide how to apply the laws. And then it has, it tries to set some guidelines as well for how to count the credits in the case of the greenhouse gas initiatives, and also how you just make it a stakeholder process that's transparent. I'll very quickly touch on the second sort of example, which is alternative energy on the OCS, and I'll just briefly cover what's going on there, and then we've got lots of time for Q&A, and we can talk about it some more then. Essentially, as Catherine mentioned, the Energy Act of 2005 provided MMS with new statutory authority to develop a regulatory regime for offshore alternative energy uses and for alternative uses of existing oil and gas infrastructure. As an environmental lawyer, what's interesting about the MMS OCS framework is that by law they have to look at things other than environmental impact, and so some of the major issues that agency is facing in the NEPA and rulemaking processes that they're in the middle of have to do with requirements that relate to the financial implications of the uses. So they've got to come up with a regime to develop a leasing, right-of-way fee royalty structure for an emerging industry where it may be startup money and just not the traditional oil and gas kind of leasing scenario where the economic assumptions and the economic model of the business are well understood. So beyond the environmental challenges that they have in that rulemaking, there's this whole other set of challenges about how they do that and how they sort of fit a new structure on top of the structure that's in place and not have, deal with the issue of conflicting uses between already approved uses and imagined future uses. MMS has done a couple of things recently. They've just recently released the NEPA environmental impact statement for the programmatic review, which is really saying what are the the likely implications of even having a regulatory program that deals with these issues. And they've given, they sort of looked out 5 to 7 years. In the EIS document, they've developed, I think, 52 or 54 best management practices, which I think for anybody interested in this, just look at those. That's a precursor to what you're going to see in the proposed regulations. And they've made it clear in their recent proclamations and issuance of this EIS document that they have authority in the interim before they develop the regulatory the rules, the actual rules, that they have authority under the Act in the interim to go ahead and consider lease applications, use applications for primarily science and research activities in the interim. And they're actively considering a couple of those, apparently. Longer term, they are, MMS has said that they expect to propose the new rules for this new alternative energy regime later this year and very ambitiously seek to finalize them by the end of 2008. And then in terms of the NEPA process, now that they've completed the programmatic level, we'll go on to engage in a NEPA process for the rulemaking itself and then for project specifics. But really the point in all of that is it's a brand new regulatory regime. There's a lot of commercial interest in alternative energy period, but alternative energy off the coast. I think the Cape Wind project is an example of what happens when the regulatory frameworks are unclear and you've got lots of different agencies and interests wanting to put a stake in the ground and make sure that what they're concerned about is addressed properly and protected. So, again, another place in this in the regulatory scheme where there's a great deal of uncertainty and a lot that remains to be figured out from this point forward.
Great. Thanks, Karen. I'd like to turn it over to Carla to talk a little bit about management and NOAA's role and how they address scientific uncertainty and inform some of the processes that are going on.
Thank you, Catherine, and it's a pleasure to be on this panel with some former colleagues from earlier days and some new colleagues, so I'm always a little bit nervous when I get on a panel with scientists, but at least I've got a lawyer sitting next to me. So I was really excited to be asked to participate in this panel just because a huge part of my job at NOAA is energy-related issues, and I think until recently, the words NOAA and energy were not necessarily in the same sentence, but NOAA's actually been actively involved in traditional offshore oil and gas and traditional energy activities for many years now, and I'd like to give you just a little bit of background on what our role is in the traditional and the emerging offshore energy regimes, as well as a little bit about our growing aquaculture program, which Karen mentioned briefly. So at NOAA, our interest in the energy arena is very broad. It ranges from resource protection and habitat protection to the climate change science aspect. So there's a very broad interest across NOAA. It's not just in one piece of NOAA. And we have had quite a few opportunities and challenges in the past several years as some of these technologies have been coming on the scene. But as Catherine and Bill and I think Karen also all pointed out, while these new technologies have great promise, many of the uncertainties surrounding their development stem from a lack of understanding of our Earth processes. So it's very difficult to formulate environmentally sound energy strategies when we lack fundamental data on fundamental questions like how much of a given resource is available, how much of that resource do we need, and how will the environment be impacted if we extract or utilize that resource. So today I want to talk with you a little bit about how we at NOAA are working to help provide some of the answers, and I see quite a few NOAA faces in the audience, so if I get something wrong, they'll correct me on it. So just so for those of you not familiar with NOAA, NOAA's mission is to understand and predict changes in the Earth's environment and to conserve and manage coastal and marine resources to meet the nation's economic, social, and environmental needs. So in short, we are looking to provide better information for better decision making. So our participation in current and future ocean energy is basically twofold. We have a very active consultation role, and we have a very, very limited permitting responsibility, which a lot of people are not familiar with, and I'll touch on a little bit later. As Karen mentioned, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 placed jurisdiction for permitting alternate uses in the outer continental shelf with the Minerals Management Service at Department of Interior. We work as in a consultation process for a number of ocean energy projects that impact our trust resources and programs. Our stewardship responsibilities include marine mammals, endangered and threatened marine and anadromous species, 13 marine sanctuaries, and one marine national monument, sustainable fisheries, and essential fish habitat. Our consultative services are mandated by various laws that require us to protect marine fisheries, marine mammals, and the living habitats that sustain them. The Endangered Species Act is one of our statutory authorities, which provides for the conservation of endangered and threatened species and the conservation of the habitats and ecosystems on which they depend. It requires federal agencies such as the Minerals Management Service, the federal FERC, I'm not going to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We work with a lot of acronyms, and it's a lot easier just to use the acronym sometimes, with FERC and MARAD on activities that may affect our listed species. Under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, we're responsible for the conservation of essential fish habitat. Our regulations require that the licensing agencies consult with NOAA Fisheries about actions that would adversely affect essential fish habitat. Our scientific and management knowledge on these issues is also a benefit to industry as they look at how they plan their projects and how they what the implications will be to existing uses such as fishing, shipping, defense activities, research, and other existing uses. The Marine Mammal Protection Act prohibits, with certain exceptions, the take, injury, or harassment of any marine mammal in U.S. waters. And the National Marine Sanctuaries Act provides authority for us to issue regulations that specify what can and cannot take place within a national marine sanctuary. The Act requires federal agencies whose actions are likely to destroy, cause the loss of, or injure a sanctuary resource to consult with the program before taking action. Then, in that case, we at NOAA recommend reasonable and prudent mitigation measures for the project. And finally, the last of the big acts, there are quite a few statutory authorities that we have, but the Coastal Zone Management Act, which Karen also mentioned, provides for the management of the nation's coastal resources and aims to balance economic development with environmental protection. The consistency provision of the Coastal Zone Management Act, as Karen mentioned, does allow the states to have a say in the process and look at whether the project that is being developed is consistent with their state coastal zone management program. If it is not, there is an appeals process that the decision can be appealed to the Secretary of Commerce. So that's just a very, very brief synopsis of the statutory authorities that we work under. And while they're very complex, NOAA does support expanded environmentally sound ocean energy developments that ensure marine life and their habitats are protected. Working with the licensing agencies such as FERC, such as MARAD, we analyze the impacts that these projects will have, such as destruction of fish and fish larvae, for instance, from water intake mechanisms, the threat of increased ship strike from the increased transportation involved with these projects, the acoustic impacts during construction, adverse effects to essential fish habitat, hazardous waste resuspension impacts that have been one of the things that we've had to look at, and entanglements from displaced fishing gear. But we have been working cooperatively with our stakeholders, with industry, with our fellow federal agencies on these issues, and it has been our experience that the emerging energy sectors, the emerging alternate use sectors, do respect our mandates and do rely on us for information on their planning procedures. But given the uncertainty of the impacts, again, we get back to a common thread, I think, the uncertainty of impacts associated with these emerging technologies, it will be necessary to use adaptive management measures as we proceed, and base that on knowledge gained from monitoring and the other studies that are out there. We have some significant expertise that will help industry and other government agencies make informed decisions with respect to moving forward in a way that has a minimal impact on our marine resources and marine life in general and their habitat. But in order to fulfill our obligation to conserve and manage the living ocean, we must be cognizant of energy technology trends, and we must continue to improve the quality of our information, the information we have about our natural environment. A good example of one of the adaptive management measures, or an example of how we've had to use adaptive management measures, is the emerging liquefied natural gas field. I think it was in 2003 the Congress passed the Deepwater Ports Act, which we've been working with FERC on onshore for quite some time, where we went through the litany of all those statutory authorities I just went through and worked with them on that. The deep water ports are typically further, well, they're deep water, kind of obvious. The deep water ports, because of the new technologies we were dealing with, there was a lot of having to do on-the-ground work with the applicants and understand more about the technologies and really understand a little bit more about a field that we were not as familiar with. But as you all know, natural gas is considered a very attractive fuel from an environmental perspective, and globally we have a lot. Nationally, I think we have about 4% of the global supply, so in order to meet our growing demand, which the Department of Energy, I believe, has said, we're going to increase our importation from 0.2 trillion cubic feet, which was the 2002 figure, to 4.8 trillion cubic feet by 2025. So it's obvious we're going to have to be importing a lot more than we already are in order to meet our demand. So as many as 40 LNG terminals have been proposed, are under construction, or have been approved. There are 6 operating terminals right now that we have worked very closely with MARAD and the Coast Guard on getting those projects up and running in the least environmentally, in the way that is most protective of the environment. But we consult with FERC and MARAD on the completeness of the LNG applications, the thoroughness of their NEPA analysis, the impacts to marine mammals and threatened or endangered species, essential fish habitat, and marine sanctuaries. But again, this has been an area where we've had to take a look at some new and intriguing technology and see how our statutory mandates will be, or our trust resources will be impacted by utilizing those new and intriguing technologies. So Catherine mentioned wave, tidal, and I think wind in her introduction. One of the things she did not mention is a very little-known permitting role that NOAA has in the ocean energy field. And it's, just to frame it, you'll recall there was a growing interest in alternative energy in the late 70s. In 1980, Congress placed jurisdiction within NOAA for setting up a licensing regime for what is called ocean thermal energy conversion, or OTEC, again, another acronym because I hate walking through the whole name. So OTEC technology converts solar radiation into electric power. The systems use the ocean's natural thermal gradient, which is the different layers of temperature in the ocean, to drive a power producing cycle. So as long as the temperature delta is around 20 degrees Celsius, the OTEC system can generate a substantial amount of power. In recent years, pretty much just in the last year, Congress has renewed its interest in OTEC, and several pieces of legislation have directed NOAA to proceed with licensing offshore thermal energy conversion facilities. Well, getting into one of the regulatory challenges we have here, NOAA promulgated regulations for OTEC in 1981, but in 1986, we still had no applications, so we pulled the regulations from the Federal Register. We also don't have a program office anymore with no regulations and no reason to have people sitting around with the crickets chirping waiting for an application. We disbanded our OTEC office, and we also have not received any funding for OTEC activities since 1986. Right now, we are looking at, there's a renewed interest in the industrial world for OTEC. There are companies who believe that this is a economically and technically viable technology. So right now at NOAA, we have a team that's getting together and trying to be ready in the event we do get an application in the next near future. But again, it's been 27 years since that those regulations were first promulgated. So anyway, just wanted to throw that out there because not many people know about ocean thermal energy conversion and NOAA's actual very small role in the permitting world. Switching from energy a little bit to aquaculture, Karen also mentioned aquaculture a bit in her remarks. There is a growing interest in increasing our ability to conduct offshore aquaculture in the marine environment. We are looking at creating domestic seafood supply to meet the growing demand for all seafood products. Currently, about 70% of the seafood that we in this country eat is imported, and at least 40% of those imports are farmed seafood. Additional U.S. aquaculture can help the nation reduce its $8 billion seafood trade deficit. I have to tell you, when the first time I saw that number, I thought somebody accidentally put a B where an M should be, but we actually have about an $8 billion seafood trade deficit. But in addition to that, it would provide additional jobs and revenue for coastal communities, and it would meet the growing consumer demand for safe and healthy seafood. Presently, most of our U.S. aquaculture is shellfish, which is conducted onshore or in coastal areas. But there is new technology and equipment, and the promising results of several open ocean aquaculture demonstration projects in state waters that are pointing the way to opportunities for seafood farming further out into the federal waters of our exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, which is 3,000 to 2,000 miles offshore. So while there are potential benefits to aquaculture, there are also barriers blocking the expansion of aquaculture into federal waters. There's currently no clear mechanism for the permitting of offshore aquaculture in the United States. And again, this is an issue that was raised in the Ocean Commission report that Karen mentioned. But to address this challenge, the administration has proposed the National Offshore Aquaculture Act of 2007, which has been introduced in both the House and the Senate. If passed, this legislation will grant the Secretary of Commerce new authority to issue seafood for aquaculture in federal waters of the EEZ while providing environmental and other safeguards to protect wild stocks, marine ecosystems, and other users, as well as economic incentives to encourage investment in marine aquaculture. The permits would specify the location of the offshore operation, the species to be grown, and the type of production system. The Act does not supersede existing authorities, but it specifically provides for coordination and consultation with other federal agencies, with our fishery management councils, and with the coastal states. So that is something, again, working across governments, I think, was a theme in one of Bill's examples. And that's kind of where I want to go now, a little bit off topic from oceans for a minute. All of these activities that we are talking about, and I know that Margaret will talk about is, again, the overarching theme is we need a more comprehensive understanding of our Earth processes. We are working. One of the recommendations of the Ocean Commission was to set up a committee on ocean policy, which is a cabinet-level committee. And under that, there is the interagency, Margaret, help me, Interagency Committee on Science Resource Management Integration.
Thank you.
You do get really used to just saying ICOS Army, which is a very unwieldy acronym. But under ICOS Army, we have looked at developing an ocean research priorities plan. We are looking at a multipurpose marine cadastre, which we're working very closely with MMS and our other federal agencies to start looking at, you know, what are the layers of responsibilities and roles out in the open ocean. So I think we are looking, I think we have made some really good strides in trying to set up a governance regime that is cross-agency, is multi-layered and multifaceted. But we also made great strides on developing an integrated ocean observing system. That's important, obviously, for development in the open ocean, but it also provides information on just environmental baselines on population and abundance trends in the marine life world. The potential for threats, the identification of potential threats is another use for an ocean observation system, and risk and uncertainty quantification. So we are learning more about the ocean. I think our integrated ocean observing system, which Margaret was instrumental in getting off the ground, so thank you for that, Margaret. But the big thing is it all kind of comes back to the three questions that I kind of started out with. I mean, how much of a given resource is available? We need a comprehensive observation system to know that. How much of that resource do we need, and how will the environment be impacted? I think we need a better body of understanding about our Earth before we can answer those questions. So, again, the potential for industrialized uses of the ocean are immense. The scientific uncertainty that we are facing is, again, going to be something that's not just agency to agency, and it's not just federal government to state government, but it is a global effort that we'll have to take on. So thanks.
Thank you, Carla. I'd like to now turn to Margaret, who's going to provide us with some comments on a real-world example and the challenges that a potentially emerging industry faces in terms of the scientific and regulatory uncertainty surrounding ocean fertilization.
Sure. My company, Climos, is focused on trying to explore a lot of the research that's been done on technologies for removing CO2 from the atmosphere. And the first one that we have focused on is ocean iron fertilization. And I'm not going to talk about the pros and cons of ocean iron fertilization. That's a different conversation. But what I'd like to focus on is exactly this point about the uncertainties in this area, and uncertainties on the science side, on the governance side, on the private sector side. I think that this the emerging desire to try to do something about carbon emissions and climate change is really going to force all of us who have worked on the science side, on the public side, and on the governance side to step up our activities and to face some challenges that we really don't want to face in answering questions. Not just the problems that we don't want to face about climate change. But we're at a nexus where we have incredible concern from certainly the science community and now more and more the public and policymakers about the implications of accelerating global emissions. We know that we're now on a tripling track for CO2, not a doubling track. We are seeing impacts from climate change in in the polar regions especially, but elsewhere, that are much greater than our models were suggesting that they were going to be. And this is coming at a time of, I'll just characterize it as deliberate action on the part of governments, not just this government, but all governments, in making their way through. The caution on the part of the world community in addressing this has led us to the place where it's going to be very difficult to address. A recent set of models published in Geophysical Research Letters by Weaver and his colleagues looked at the implications of all of the legislative proposals that are in front of the U.S. and said, in the abstract, that there was no way that we wouldn't pass 450 ppm of carbon with any, even the most aggressive of those legislative impact legislative proposals, and that there was no way to avoid 450 ppm of carbon in the atmosphere without removing carbon directly from the atmosphere, not just zeroing emissions, but removing carbon. So on the one hand, we have this big, scary thing sitting in front of us. Second, we have on the ocean side, because of the very close connection between the oceans and climate, a very integral relationship on the research side, also on the impact side. And so one of the things that we're hearing more and more about is ocean acidification. There's going to be a major paper that's coming out in about 3 months, which will give an even more alarming story about the impact of ocean acidification. So we have the climate side, we have the ocean impact side. And moving into this is a very substantial interest on the part of the private sector in doing something about it. They feel that they had a very important role that they played in several other interactions between regulators and environmentalists, for example, in NOx and SOx emissions and so forth, and feel that technology from the private sector, action from the private sector, has to be an important part of this. So in the last 3 years, there has been more investment on the part of venture capital in the area of both technology to deal with emissions, but also in mitigation, than there has been in many of the traditional venture capital and technology sectors. Recently, the 8 largest pension funds in the world, with many trillions of dollars under management, met after the Davos meeting in London, in a meeting hosted by Prince Charles, to discuss whether they would jointly agree to put a particular percentage of their pension fund investments into venture capital into the clean tech, green tech, carbon mitigation realm. 0.5% of their investments would result in more investment in this area than the entire federal government in the last 10 years. That's an extraordinary amount, and they're very capable of doing it. So that means that, and you see the private sector both on the venture capital side and on the commercial side saying, we want to come in, we want to try to address this. So there's a lot of action. The next piece is that scientists are beginning to talk about some things that were really unthinkable in the past. The discussion about modification of climate or geoengineering has been going on for a very long time, but it was really something that people didn't want to talk about. No one wants to inject aerosols into the stratosphere. No one wants to have to fertilize the ocean to solve a problem that we should have solved in other ways. But we're also seeing the scientific discussion of that start to come out in public and start to be a credible scientific discussion. Another piece of this is our knowledge that we have many times in the past, with all good intention, tried to solve problems with fixes, whether they were technology fixes or environmental fixes, introduction of species or introduction of techniques or whatever, that have resulted in greater harm than the problem that they were meant to address. And finally, we have what you've heard echoed across the table here, incomplete knowledge of our environmental systems and the processes that take place and the degree to which those processes are nonlinear. Even if we understand them, will they operate the same way under different conditions? Yet, all over, there are calls for actions. So this is a very, very unstable mix of, and it is the regulatory environment and the governance environment of the next decade. Probably it's very important in the next decade and probably for much of the next 30 to 50 years as we try to address this global change problem. So how do you try to operate in that very challenging arena? Some of the, I'd like to, like Bill, tell a few little stories about the challenges that are out there, not with a view toward giving you a solution, but trying to give you some sense of what you will all and we will all be grappling with. I mentioned that scientists were beginning to talk about large-scale manipulation of the environment in a way that they had never done before. In 2002, Paul Crutzen, who was one of the three people who won the first Nobel Prize in environment for discoveries related to the ozone hole, himself an extremely credible and admired expert in stratospheric chemistry, tried to publish a paper in the peer-reviewed journal Climate Change on the injection of stratospheric aerosols for albedo modification, i.e. Preventing or decreasing sunlight hitting the Earth's surface. His paper, although it was scientifically approved, was rejected for publication because it was considered to be too hot a topic for a peer-reviewed journal. The journal agreed to publish it as an editorial comment, and from there, lots happened. The entire journal article, or the entire journal issue, turned into basically a public debate about this. And it ended with an editorial essay by Ralph Cicerone, now the executive director of the National Academy of Science. And the title of his paper sort of said it all in terms of what he said, and that was Responsible Science, Responsible Scientific Research, and Participation in Oversight. So Ralph was essentially telling our scientific community, you have got to learn to deal with this, and you've got to approach it dispassionately as a scientist and evaluate it on scientific terms, but also be very involved in whatever goes on in terms of oversight of development of regulation, oversight of deployment, and so forth. Since that time, scientists have, I think Ralph's essay kind of made it okay to talk about this in a way that hadn't happened in the past. A Harvard workshop on geoengineering was held in November, And it was a very interesting workshop. And one of the most interesting things was to see the struggle of the scientific community try to talk about this issue of doing research on such a controversial topic. So some of the participants said, and it was a closed workshop, there were 40 people there, you know, the glitterati of stratospheric chemistry and so forth. And they said, you know, should we allow research to go on this topic? I mean, it's a very unscientific point of view. And, you know, someone soon pointed out, well, you know, maybe you can stop research in the U.S., but it's not going to stop elsewhere. And so it's just an example of the difficulty for even the science community to start looking at these topics. Roger Angel, who's one from Arizona State, who's one of the scientists who works on the issue of mirrors in space, used a small amount of his discretionary budget from his NASA grant to synthesize some of his work on that. NASA told him that if he ever used any of his funds from NASA for that again, he wouldn't get any more funding from NASA. So this is very difficult space. On the other hand, the lack of funding in this area is something that all of the scientists talk about and say, well, how can we answer the questions? How can we deal with the issues that are brought up if we don't start doing some research? A wonderful example that sort of comes closer to, I like it because it's not aerosols in space and it's not fertilizing the ocean, it's wind turbines. We tend to think of wind as a very important technology that could be deployed in this space. Ron Prynne from MIT and his colleagues recently ran a model that showed what happens if you have high penetration wind turbine deployment, i.e., you really want to address the problem in the areas where wind is, where you really can do this, like Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado. So they deployed wind turbines at a scale of one per kilometer in the areas where the wind velocity was great enough to really make an impact. And what does a wind turbine do? It takes kinetic energy out of the atmosphere. That's what, on purpose, in order to make electricity. Taking kinetic energy out of the atmosphere affects the atmospheric circulation and it affects the hydrologic cycle. And even with that experiment, they found a profound impact on the hydrology of not only the Southwest, but it impacted the hydrology of the eastern North Pacific Ocean just from that deployment. So that's a potent lesson to us on how complicated this is, the amount of research, and also the fact that models and model predictions are a very, very important part of this. And modelers will also tell you, you know, our models are only a representation. They are not reality. They're a scenario. So we're trying to do all of this in a very, very difficult climate for science. What about governance? We heard a little bit about the London Convention and the London Protocol and the challenge of defining when the London Convention was applicable and when it was not. I think that one of the wonderful examples here is what happened in the London Convention when they were challenged with whether or not the deep injection of CO2 into geologic formation beneath the North Sea came under the London Convention, which used to, of course, be the London Anti-Dumping Convention. You know, was this under their purview? The convention decided that it was and proceeded to look at this. The big concern was the potential release, especially catastrophic release of that CO2, and whether that would influence ocean acidity in light of this big problem of ocean acidification. It was eventually modeling that was used to address the question and present scenarios of what this would be like for the convention. But I think one of the very interesting things was that the London Convention had been in operation for 38 years at that point. They had never before taken a vote. Everything had been by consensus because the decisions were so clear. The first vote of the parties was over this issue. I think that is it's an example to us that the things that we're talking about and the challenges that we're facing and the solutions that people are trying to point at those are going to challenge the structures and the governance that we have put in place. It's really, I was shocked when I heard that. Not that they should take a vote, but that nothing had been as contentious as that issue before. In the U.S., things in this space move between, everybody's interested in them. Department of State, obviously, is our agent for representation for international agreements, EPA, NOAA, but DOE is starting to take a much greater interest in this. NASA, from the standpoint of providing data and information, Minerals Management Service, all down the line. EPA currently says that they are the agency within the U.S. who would give a permit, if a permit was being sought, for the release of material into the ocean. And in a recent discussion with some fairly high-level people at NOAA, they expressed great surprise that EPA would be the agency responsible for this and said that perhaps that should be looked at again. So I think, even in our internal structures, there's a lot of uncertainty about how this works. Then there's the corporate side. So if you, with the intention of trying to do something that would assist in addressing the problems of global change and mitigation, enter this space, how do you act? What do you do? I think that it requires a sensitivity to these kinds of concerns that really calls for a different kind of behavior on the part of the corporate side, the private sector. And we have been trying to understand how to move forward in that way, with the understanding that if we were a corporation that actually conducted some experiments or did something, we might be the first company who had operated in that very contentious space of geoengineering. So we're aware that we are setting examples that may either be good examples for people to say, this worked in the past and how can you make it work in the future, or examples that will be so toxic that people will apply them in a sense that people will legislate and regulate in opposition to them, and so forth. So what we have tried to do to try to step into this space very carefully is, as Karen said, we have published what we call a code of conduct, and it's certainly a work in progress. And it actually evolved between the time that we first developed it and the time that we put it on the website in response to concerns that had been raised by agencies and concerns that had been raised by the London Convention, and I expect that it will continue to evolve. The idea was based on a voluntary code of conduct that was developed for research and corporate interactions in nanotechnology. It was done by DuPont working with Environmental Defense. So some of the pieces of this that we think are very important are, as Karen alluded to, voluntary adherence to regulation without arguing the legal issue about whether that regulation is valid in international law and whether you couldn't go to court and have it struck down. But in this space, I think that voluntary adherence to what governments are struggling with as a good kind of regulation sets the stage to maybe allow a little bit more forward progress in saying, okay, and those regulations may still become more strict, but if there's voluntary adherence without litigation over the impact of that in this extremely tough space, and I'm not just talking about ocean fertilization or geoengineering, because you see how it could work into, offshore wind turbines in general and so forth. I think a second important thing is voluntary adherence to the highest standards of the market. In the case of ocean fertilization, the market thing, the people that would pay you to do it would be buying carbon offsets. There's a lot of activity within that market concerned about the quality of offsets and the quality of behavior. So I think standards that allow the public and the market to be confident that what they are buying has been well-defined, that it's not being sold more than once, that it really happened, and so forth. Those are also, market standards are also very important. A third area is adherence to the highest standards of the science. If we are going to do things like deploy wind turbines very large scales, or wind turbines offshore, or put aerosols into the stratosphere, or have or fertilize portions of the ocean, we had better be working with the people who are the recognized experts on this and who have the highest scientific credibility. And I think, regardless of intellectual property activities, that we have to adhere to the highest standards of transparency for the information that comes out of those activities. So one of the pieces that we've talked about is that all of the information from any cruise that we sponsored or that was undertaken would go immediately into the public domain. It's an issue for some of the scientists because they're used to having control of the data for a couple of years in order to be able to pursue their scientific thinking. And this says we're going to throw that model out and just put the data out there. I think that certainly a go slow approach, saying let's do some things and then evaluate them, is another important piece. But a dialogue over those elements of what does the science community expect, what does the governmental community expect, what does the rest of the private sector expect, what do NGOs expect in terms of behavior, is really called for in this space as well. And so that's what we wanted to stimulate with this. Even if we proceed with the highest levels of standards, the highest levels of scientific activity and so forth, we ultimately are going to still be facing very, very tough questions, tough choices between consequences. And that comes down to some very tough issues relating to ethics. And again, I'll use the example of a very broad deployment of wind turbines. You could do that. There is nothing right now that would prevent you, if you had license to use the property, to deploy at that scale, affecting the local circulation and even the regional circulation. And it would be done, it would be done with the goal of, here's clean energy, renewable energy. We're not contributing to CO2 emissions. And we're developing something that's high tech, that's good for the country in terms of business, but it could have this impact. And those are the kinds of trade-offs that we're going to have to look at more and more. There was no doubt on the part of in the minds of the London Convention that if Sleipner sequestration failed catastrophically, that there would be a big dose of CO2 that would go into the ocean that would result in an impact on ocean acidity. But a decision was made about the relative magnitude of that, the relative risk of that, and the certainty of the emissions if it didn't happen. And I think those are some very potent challenges that we're all going to have to face in this space. So I should have said right at the beginning, thank you to the Environmental Law Institute for having these discussions. I think they're very important, and for having them be open to all of the sectors that are interested. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Margaret. And I'd like to thank our panel before we switch over to a discussion. I really appreciate you all coming together on this issue. And I think that Margaret's talk highlighted the rationale for this seminar series and the struggle that we're facing. And as somebody who is deeply interested in ocean conservation, I look at climate change on the one hand as being causing major impacts, ocean acidification, temperature rise, loss of reefs. These are huge things. And the solutions to them are also going to impact the ocean in a negative way. And I think it was correct in saying that the trade-offs, we need to make trade-offs, and we're going to make trade-offs either consciously or we're going to do it haphazardly. And I think ultimately what I would love to see is us moving towards making conscious decisions about the trade-offs that we're facing. And I would love to hear as a first question to our panel, what are the legal mechanisms at this point for making the trade-offs that we need to make, or how do we exist in this realm of uncertainty and make the trade-offs that we need to make without an obvious governance framework to do it? I'll let you start, Karen.
Okay. I think my first response would be that the law is, as in a lot of environmental law over the years, the law is going to lag behind the science and the policy making. And, the Congress moves slowly, and for all the reasons that you articulated, that it's such a challenge for even the scientific community to have a candid discussion amongst itself. I think everybody's aware of what the politics of climate change have been in the last several years in this country, and I think there's great momentum now to move climate change legislation in some areas, but I don't think any of the legislation that is getting a lot of attention, certainly nothing that has a political reality of being passed, is going to tackle many of the issues that we've been talking about here today. It's far too complex for that to happen. And so I think it's interesting, the story about the London Convention and the CO2, because I don't know exactly what happened there, but I think and you see this in some of the turf battles that are starting to become even more and more prominent and visible with the federal agencies. It's sort of comforting on one level that people seem to want to do the right thing. And I imagine that the London Convention looked at that and behind closed doors maybe said, who knows if we've got jurisdiction. But if we don't look at it, who will? And I think there's going to be a lot of that, that if, you know, clients come to us and they say, what do we do? And depending on their ethical code, you know, sort of the culture of the organization, they're gonna look at a code of conduct and say, we want to be among the best too, and we want to volunteer, we want to adhere to these standards, we're gonna do that. So I don't think, maybe Carla has a different point of view on this as a lawyer. I think that people working in this realm are gonna have to look at the laws, but it's gonna take a lot of creativity in the legal realm, as well as in the scientific realm, as well as in the management realm, because the tools we have to work with weren't designed for these problems. And if if people sort of say, well, the law doesn't allow me to do that, or I don't know what the law allows me to do, and so I'm not going to face it, you know, you can't make progress. And so I think people who are interested in making progress are going to look at the law, look at the science, look at the things, and say, okay, we've got this layer of uncertainty in all of these areas. What's the right choice? What are the right choices to make? That's my response.
No, I would agree. And just one observation,
Margaret was advocating a go slow approach with the science, and your comment about Congress moving slow. You think they would be comfortable?
Go slow approach with commercialization.
I'm sorry, that's what I meant. I think those would be complementary, but not so much. I think one of the ways that we are looking at it, and Margaret also was very active with this group, we have, in addition to our ocean policy group and our other interagency groups, we have a climate change interagency working group on climate change science and technology, where we do bring policymakers from mostly the science-based agencies together to discuss some of these things. And as Margaret experienced, those are, some very interesting meetings, because you have science agencies coming from completely different areas of science, where what works for one area of science does have a different effect on another area of science. So I think the interagency approach is the way we are looking at it, so that we can make decisions that are consistent, that do kind of take into account not just our ocean and atmospheric interests, but also clean water and clean air interests and all of the different aspects. So it's not going to be an easy fix anywhere in the near future, but it's something that we do have to, again, work across agencies, across governments, and across sectors to address.
So I just realized that the clock that I was keeping track of has stopped. I think that all of us were looking at this clock, and I'm guessing it's actually not still 1:25. I have no idea what time it is. It's almost 2:00. I'm very sorry. I would have sped everybody up, but I was tracking our progress. And I thought, wow, we're doing so well, and then I realized that the second hand wasn't moving. Which I'm sorry about that to both the folks on the phone who haven't had a chance to provide comments in the audience. But I think that if there are people, I don't know what time it is. I mean, it's almost 2 now, or it is 2 now. If people need to leave, that is appropriate. And I don't know if the panelist is willing to stay and address some questions. If some of you have questions, please ask up here in front and then be directly behind.
Yes, I was wondering, would there be any political or economic incentives for any actors to take sort of a rogue approach on some of the kind of interventions you were talking about, Margaret? Like one sometimes hears about winners and losers in climate change. At the state level, in terms of of geography, and also in terms of individual companies or individuals, would there be any incentive for someone to try to increase their share of something or other and to beggar their neighbor?
It's very interesting that you brought that up. One of the areas of very active discussion during that geoengineering workshop was whether. Some of the people that said, no, it's very important for us to do research and understand this came from a concern that it is, although it's expensive, it's not irrationally expensive to do it. And they conceived of the idea of somebody they called a green finger, like gold finger, green finger, who would just decide to do it and solve the problem for their country. So that it was no longer an issue, you know, whether you could do that regionally or whatever. So this issue of rogue activity is a very important one, and it's very challenging for the governance systems because people working in some of it's different if you're in the coastal zone. But even out for, you know, although there's international fisheries laws, very difficult to even deal with that and regulate on that, no less something that deals with the open ocean or atmospheric aerosols or whatever. That's an excellent point.
Harlan?
I had a comment more than a question, I will admit. I wanted to say that the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which incorporates customary international law, has an obligation under which states have accepted the obligation to protect and preserve the marine environment. And I think building on that, one could say that as the convention provides for various rights and obligations of states, there is also an obligation to ensure that those subject to your national jurisdiction do not take away from the rights of others, so that I think one could argue that states do have an obligation to ensure that their nationals do not just go out there into the open ocean and do whatever they want, both because they have to cooperate with other states to protect and preserve the marine environment. They also have to cooperate to protect marine living resources under another article. And then there are the different parts that address certain other areas and obligations. London Convention, of course, is one, but there is an obligation with respect to marine scientific research to share the data, and that comes into what you were saying, Margaret, putting the information out there would be a step towards fulfilling that obligation. So I think it's not only the London Convention, it's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and of course the IMO Convention, that the jurisdiction is regulatory authority is complex, and so one really does have to examine various other legal obligations that states have. And a quick way forward would be environmental impact assessment to have some sense of outcomes that may result from your actions, and then monitoring and sharing the information. So that was just a comment. Sorry. Thank you.
Are there other?
Following on what you just said about the oceans and the authority of governments over international waters, where it doesn't seem that there's any real authority there. It might be customary international law, and the permit process doesn't really exist when it comes to having industrial operations in the oceans. So that's something that is definitely going to occur in the future. So I'm wondering, since the oceans are such an important factor in determining the future of the environment, what else is there?
Well, I'll take a shot at that because that's a tough one. I think that we're due for a major societal paradigm shift in the way we think about the planet. And I think it's stimulated through the climate change discussion that's gone on in the last few years at the public level. And you know, if we kind of look back through history, we've had large paradigm shifts. The Copernican Revolution changing our view of where we are in the solar system, the Einstein and relativity and Darwin and evolution, go on and on. And that's where science is effectively communicated to the broader public. And I think that this, I've always been talking to my colleagues, my marine science colleagues and trying to get them to think about doing more than just studying problems, solving problems. And it turns out it's kind of a right brain, left brain thing because you know, to study problems, you need the dispassionate rigor, objective, and peer review, and you got to get it right at all costs. And to solve problems, you got to say, I care, and you have to be able to work with stakeholders, and you have to get it done in time windows of opportunity that present themselves. So there's this kind of struggle between the right and the left hemispheres of your brain when doing that. And when Margaret was talking in particular, I began to realize that analogy I use about how individuals operate is really a global sense of how in the legal profession and the scientific realm, how we have to combine the left and the right hemispheres of what we do and try to tackle these problems in a way that makes an iron fertilization experiment on that grand scale, just that experiment in how we attempt to do these things. And so I treat the kind of level of the geoengineering, or whatever we called it, that is in fact just an extension of the scientific method of experiment and hypothesis testing. So I will say that going back to that analogy of right and left hemisphere, that we have in our brain this corpus callosum that connects, and that's, you know, that's a lot of creativity. In the connections. And so that's what we need at a societal level, is those connections of working, you know, people like Catherine who have a PhD and a JD. Yeah. You know, we need those connections where we try to wrestle those very complex problems on that scale of the planet.
Can I respond to that too? I all the panels I'm ever on oceans, one of the points I think is worth making is the issue of visibility. And I think you made the point at the beginning of the panel that a lot of attention doesn't get paid to these issues because we don't see what's underwater, and certainly that's true of what happens on the open oceans. So rather than be hopeless, I would say work to raise visibility. That's going to make that's a key component in addition to what you talked about.
And just sitting here listening to all this, the issue that keeps rising up to me is that, as you folks said, as lawyers or scientists, do you really see any trend that will get us past the application for a permit if you somehow make it sound reasonable you're going to get a permit? The Ocean Commission's talked about the precautionary principle. But the way law is set up in this country is that if you apply for a permit and you aren't shown to be damaging something, you're going to get a permit regardless of what the cumulative impacts of 100 decisions down the road will be. And I just wondered if anybody is seeing any trends either in this country or elsewhere where we're starting to get more towards a planned approach as opposed to a permit-by-permit approach that is the world.
When you say that we don't really take into account cumulative impacts, we actually do that, and I think it's important to, under our permitting structure for the offshore it's being developed right now through MMS for the alternate uses, but the traditional uses does have a permitting structure that is an interagency structure. So we at NOAA, through NOAA Fisheries, through our sanctuaries program, we do look at cumulative impacts of long-term effects. Now, a lot of that is modeling. A lot of that is, as Margaret pointed out, that's not exact science. But we do take that into consideration and actually offer mitigation measures to the applicants to address issues where we feel that there will be long-term cumulative impacts. So I'm not sure I understand the entirety of your question, but I did want to point out that we do approach the permitting from NOAA's perspective on a case-by-case basis, a permit-by-permit basis, because the technologies are evolving, the siting of the projects has to be taken into consideration. So each project is unique, and
does require a project by project evaluation. So I don't know if that answers part of your question or.
Yeah, and I just think it is a question of exercise of science. Mm-hmm. We continue to make these decisions and find out that the science wasn't good. And then we see that we're getting more and more mm-hmm. problems adding to it. Mm-hmm.
One comment I'd make is that when we talked with EPA about permitting in this, they said that there has never been a permit granted by EPA under the permitting rules of the London Convention, and only one permit has been sought, and that was for a research experiment co-sponsored by DOE and was the direct liquid CO2 injection off Hawaii.
Is that NSF?
NSF was not involved, but I was wondering whether NOAA was.
I think we were, but I thought it was more than two agencies.
It was being done by the scientific community mm-hmm. and a NOAA lab, but it was was sponsored by federal agencies. And that was ultimately withdrawn because the public reaction was so vitriolic. The things that they called the scientists who were just trying to do an experiment were truly extraordinary. And eventually they withdrew the request for the permit and never carried out the experiment. So it's another example of just getting research on what impacts will be in these controversial areas is very, very tough for the science community.
I'd just like to follow up with a comment as moderator, but maybe acting, putting my panelist hat on in terms of the cumulative impacts question, because I think that it's one of the key issues that we're struggling with. We're studying ecosystem-based management and whether or not ecosystem-based management can help address, if it's going to be effective, it has to address this issue of cumulative impacts. And I think that while there are attempts to deal with cumulative impacts and there are laws like NEPA that they consider cumulative impacts, that the reality is it's very difficult to do it in practice. And it's one thing to do it within a sector, say you're going to cut off, you will only allow so much impervious surface and then you're done. That's one approach to addressing cumulative impacts and you stop permitting. But I think that there's an even greater challenge that the ocean is the endpoint for all of the activities we do on land, that it all ends up there, either through the atmosphere, through freshwater use, through land-based sources of and how do you consider all of these different things together? And I think that scientists are struggling with how to even come up with models to think about all these things in together, and then the regulatory or legal structure doesn't address cross-sector cumulative impacts. I don't know that we have any mechanism to do that, and I think that's something that we have to try to figure out how to do in the future.
One way that we're approaching this that I really excited about is these environmental report cards that are using metrics of cumulative impact. And I think in Chesapeake Bay, it's taken us to the point where we got through the stages of denial that we had we're doing all these great things. Well, my name is Chesapeake Bay and I have a nutrient problem. You got to get over that denial and deal with the 12-step program, because it's just that little bit here, a little bit there that adds up. And I think we have to do that for the oceans. My name's Planet Earth and I got an ocean problem. And we have to figure out the kinds of connections that we can make, so that the transparency is really important, and the idea of using the science outside of the peer review system is exciting. I like that idea. I like the idea of putting results up as they're happening in a couched in the right terms and vetted through the scientific process. As much rigor as we can apply, because I think we need the creativity, the rigor, the tenacity, and ultimately, I call it the virtue. A marine biologist 100 years ago used the word and the term virtue in the quote, wisdom's knowing what to do next, virtue is doing it. So I think that's where we have to go. We have to actually start getting on with doing some of these large scale planetary experiments to solve some of the big problems we have.
Any final questions? We've worn you all down. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and for those on the phone, thank you. I look forward to seeing you all at the next one in March, and we'll talk about shipping.